You are listening to Radio Aryan for an alternative to the anti-white system. On RadioAryan.com.
I think they're getting out of hand. Well, you know what happened to those who complain. We've got to stop them seeing light. Let them think it's all right, 'cause the fireworks aren't to keep them entertained. Well, the wells have not run dry. Do we really need to lie? We'll say it's a national emergency. We'll set a wedding full of clowns, and we'll kick them while they're down. Get the banks control, 'cause they are to me. Let's go and find a better place. We'll call it New America. Won't it be a lovely place to be? Imperial material, the mind of New America, the best idea since democracy.
Hello and welcome once again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and children of all ages, to The Rope Report, Billy's Balkanization Podcast, brought to you each week on RadioAryan.com exclusively. I'm Billy Roper, and this is my show. This is the end of November episode for The Rope Report, and we're really at the cusp of the winter, when Thanksgiving's already passed, and Christmas is looming. It's the time of year that people's patience is really frayed, and rather than thinking about the reason for the season or the meaning of the holidays, they're focused on their budget. And this time, everyone's budget is just as frayed as their patience. People are stressed out and wondering how they're going to buy those all-important consumer Christmas presents. Well, here on The Rope Report, we talk each week about news and political items of interest to you and give my commentary from a political perspective just to the right of Julius Streicher. And so we're not going to talk about consumerism today. We're not going to talk about Christmas today even. We'll save that for a future episode. But I'm going to bring a lot of focus on current situation our people face, not just here in North America, but around the world. We're going to be talking about how to turn these problems around, how to actually solve them through nuts and bolts activism, instead of just complaining and whining about them all the time like we're a bunch of Jews. I'm going to tell you how you can change the way your local community thinks. I'll tell you about our Shieldwall Thanksgiving celebration, and I'll mention December the 2nd, we have an upcoming Shieldwall Network meeting in Central Arkansas. And I'll talk to you about telogeny a little bit, and about the Cover Our People With Love White Family Drive. But first, I want to share with you a mailing address that you can use to send books or letters or postcards to Jacob Goodwin, and to give you an update on his case. The day before yesterday, I had an opportunity to meet in person with Jacob's parents again and to talk with them. They were able to get two more checks that I delivered to them to actually help with Jacob's legal defense fund, cashed and deposited. So his legal defense fund is in pretty good shape right now, thanks to the generosity of listeners to The Rope Report and to readers of The Rope Report website, as well as alt-right and white nationalist patriots from across our movement and deep within our cause. Those who perhaps are not comfortable coming to demonstrations and protests and rallies themselves, but do have the wallets and the checkbooks to help out those who are fallen. So I want to thank all of you who have helped out with Jacob Goodwin's legal defense fund. Now that he's been extradited to Virginia and is facing his first initial hearing on December the 14th, the lawyers are meeting with Jacob and doing a great job in planning his legal defense. I can't talk too much at this time, understandably, about his case or the tactics or strategies that the lawyers will be using in his defense, but I will tell you that you should stay tuned, because not only are we confident in victory, but along the way to his triumphant return as a free man without a felony criminal record, Jacob will be giving all of us the opportunity to see, when the curtain is pulled aside, just how corrupt the Charlottesville, Virginia political regime truly is. So his lawyers are going to be making some motions for some changes in the next couple of weeks, which we'll bring you updates on here on The Rope Report. Sponsored, as always, by the numbers 14 and 88 and the letters H and X, and by your generous non-tax-deductible contributions to Roper_Billy@yahoo.com through PayPal. Once again, that's through PayPal to Roper_Billy@yahoo.com or through snail mail to P.O. Box 1937, Mountain View, Arkansas, 72560. Now, while you were memorizing that address, we have another one that we would like to share, and it is for Jacob Goodwin, as I said. You can actually go to a publisher like Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Books A Million online and order a book and then put Jacob Goodwin's new mailing address in the Charlottesville jail in the ship to box and have Jacob sent a book to read to pass the time. He is not as locked down as he was in the Lone Oak County, Arkansas jail. Things are slightly better then. He's been able to purchase a small radio through the commissary, and he is around like-minded people. The Charlottesville defendants are housed together separate from the other inmates. However, he really would like to have some more books to read, so we encourage you to help out Jacob by ordering through an online retailer a book that can be sent to him at the following address: Jacob Goodwin, and his prisoner number, which is very important, is 634-728. Once again, 634-728. And the address is 160 Perigory Lane, that's Peregory Lane, Charlottesville, Virginia, 22902. That's Jacob Goodwin, 634-728-160 Perigory Lane, Charlottesville, Virginia, 22902. You can also find Jacob's address listed on the Roper Report site, .wordpress.com, or through the Roper Report mirror site at whitenationalist.com. It's also posted on the Shieldwall Network site at shieldwallnetwork.wordpress.com. As I met with Jacob's parents and with others over the last week, like everyone, we've been busy with Thanksgiving holidays and with family and with friends, but as racial activists, our friends are our comrades in the movement. And so for Thanksgiving, we had about 24 Shieldwall Network members and affiliates and supporters share our Thanksgiving feast with us, and it was really a great day. Not only did we feel comfortable being in fellowship with our fellow white nationalist and political activist, but knowing that all of us in the Shieldwall Network were dedicated to the Shieldwall plan of working to establish an emerging proto-ethno-state here in the Ozarks and working with others in different parts of the country to establish their own and learning from one another as we share information. And we've been doing that a lot leading up to Thanksgiving, especially with a group in Upper New England, ironically, where they're establishing New Albion, a white ethno-state there. The seedbed for one has already been planted. And as we share ideas with other white nationalists and with pioneer Little Europe advocates across the country, we learn from them, and they learn from us. But we had a wonderful Thanksgiving celebration with our friends and with our family. It was also the kiddo's 12th birthday, and the 2 days later celebration that we had in Little Rock was a great social as well. When a lot of people from the central part of the state who had not been able to come up to the north part of the state where we had our Thanksgiving celebration, or who had Thanksgiving prior commitments with their own families and friends, were able to join us 2 days later in Little Rock. And we actually are not happy about traveling to Little Rock. Don't do it very often. It's a pretty stressful situation because it's like going on safari for us. We live in a 98% white county, and all the counties adjacent to us are over 95%, and we moved here for a reason. We live here on purpose, not by accident, not a random causation. And so when we have to go to a place like Little Rock, which is a majority black jungle, you know, we go in, we do our thing, and we leave. So that's basically what happened the day before yesterday. But it was a great reminder of the grim reality that all too many of our people live in every day. Those who have not yet voted with their feet, those who have not yet made that crucial, important decision to become domestic expatriates and to cross the lines, enter friendly territory, out of enemy-occupied space, into new America. So the experience in Little Rock, which I could detail, I could talk to you about the restaurants we went into and the bookstores and the other businesses and how we felt like we needed to be on guard, intense all the time, was not the way that white people are supposed to live. It's not a very comfortable environment for ourselves, much less for children. But we persevered and made it through it, and I think it's good every once in a while for those of us who are safely behind the front lines to be reminded through exposure of what we're dealing with as a nation. And that, in comparison, it's obvious that Little Rock is not going to be in New America. Coming up December the 2nd, we're going to have a Shield Wall Network meeting in Central Arkansas, but not in Little Rock. And we anticipate 3 to 4 dozen Shield Wall Network members and their families will be present. It's going to be a very secure area with our own Shield Wall Network phalanx on duty. In addition to a presentation on prepping and an update on recent Shield Wall Network events, Jacob Goodwin's parents will be there to talk about his case and to give an update to everyone about what he is going through in Charlottesville. We're also going to be raising funds for the Cover Our People With Love pro-white charity, White Family Drive. Now, as you may have read through Stormfront or heard about on Stormfront Radio or read about on the Roper Report website, the Cover Our People With Love pro-white charities White Family Drive for 2017 is designed to help with heating bills or with grocery costs or for warm winter coats and clothing for needy white families. We're going to close the nomination process on December the 1st, because, frankly, we don't want to take on too much. We don't want to bite off more than we can chew. We certainly want to make sure that those who apply for help or who are nominated to receive help don't fall through the cracks. We don't want to take on more families than we can actually distribute the help for. We're happy to say that we have been able to help some already. There was an elderly white lady who is a contributor on Stormfront who lives on a very low fixed income, who contacted us explaining that she could not afford to use her heat. And she lives in Pennsylvania, where it's already become cold, and it's going to be a very cold winter. And she literally did not have the funds to run her heating and did not know how she was going to make it through. Well, we have been able to achieve some help for her by having people give directly to her. We'd be glad to give you her contact information if you'd prefer to help directly. But we also encourage you to help out with providing the yarn and the quilting material and fabric to produce more of the handcrafted quilts and blankets and caps and socks and mittens, scarves, everything that my wife Tina Roper makes through the Cover Our People With Love pro-white charity. And also, if you're able to help us with donations to cover the postage and shipping to send them to needy white families this winter. So once again, the address to help out with that is P.O. Box 1937, Mountain View, Arkansas, 72560. And we encourage you to send gently worn, good quality, used clothing, especially children's clothing, and most especially for this time of year, warm winter jackets and coats, as well as any yarn or fabric material which could be used for fabrication of the quilts and blankets, or if you'd like to help out directly with donations to help out with our postage and shipping, or to help some of the needy white families with their grocery and electric bills this year. That'd be an extreme blessing for us and for the people who are served by the Cover Our People With Love pro-white charities 2017 White Family Drive. Now, as we get closer to the holiday season, as I said, we're going to cut off nominations on December the 1st. We hope that we're able to reach out to every one of these families that have been nominated or who have asked for help before Christmas, before December the 25th, and definitely by the end of the year, so that they can start 2018 on a really bright note, knowing that their people have not forgotten about them and that we do take care of our own. Now, as you reach into your wallets and reach into your hearts to help the Cover Our People with Love Pro-White Charities White Family Drive, we want to thank you for continuing to help Jacob through his commissary fund. Now, as I mentioned earlier, people have given very generously to help with his legal defense fund. And if you prefer, you can still go to fundedjustice.com or just Google the Jacob Goodwin Legal Defense Fund and make contributions, which will be allocated to his parents for his legal defense fund. We have not yet exhausted all of his legal defense funds that have been raised, thanks to your generosity. We are hoping that people might turn a corner and begin to make some of those contributions directly into Jacob Goodwin's commissary fund. And that is actually available online. You can use your debit or your credit card to help out with Jacob Goodwin's commissary fund, or what they call the inmate canteen fund, through the Albemarle.org, Albemarle County, Virginia, Regional Jail. And that inmate canteen fund can be found at Albemarle.org. And on the left sidebar, you can click on inmate canteen fund to give contributions directly into Jacob Goodwin's commissary by using his prisoner address, 160 Perigory Lane, Charlottesville, Virginia, 22902, and his inmate number, 634-728. And this helps with things that aren't provided. Surprisingly, things like extra socks and underwear and sweatshirts and food items that don't come slopped on a tray. So please, if you're able to, send Jacob Goodwin a Christmas card or a letter. We're going to bring an entire box of Christmas cards to the December 2nd Chilwell Network meeting, and everyone's going to sign them. And then over the course of a week, he's going to receive 3 or 4 or 5 Christmas cards signed by all of his friends and Chilwell Network supporters. And he'll get more and more of these each day leading up to Christmas. But we encourage you to send a Christmas card or a letter of encouragement to Jacob Goodwin. We like to ask that if you do write to Jacob, that you please don't use any overtly racial language or symbolism or numerology. Jacob Goodwin knows, if you're writing to him, what you are about and what your beliefs are. Jacob Goodwin knows, because of where he's sitting and why he is sitting there, what his beliefs are. There's no need to virtue signal to Jacob, or especially to the guards, the correctional officers who'll be reading his mail, by saying 1488, Sieg Heil, Hail Victory, or any slogans that can be used to harm Jacob's case when he comes to trial. If you put openly racialist or national socialist statements in your letters to Jacob Goodwin, that could harm his case. So please refrain from virtue signaling to Jacob Goodwin in that manner when you write to him, for his sake. Once again, the address, Jacob Goodwin, 634-728, 160 Perigory Lane, Charlottesville, Virginia, 22902. Now, as I mentioned, we've been discussing with other potential PLEs, or Pioneer Little Europe proto-ethnostates around the country, how we can share information and tactics and strategies to create communities where we have become persons of influence. Now, the leader of the Upper New England ethnostate is named Tom, and I'm not going to give his entire name because he is already a leader in his community, and I don't want to do anything or say anything counterproductive to his efforts there or their emerging success. But I do believe that the ideas that he shared with me on how you can change the way your community thinks, and work within your locally networked group, people that you've become friends with in real life to become persons of influence in your community, how that locally networked group can really become a voice to be heard and listened to in your area. Now, as Tom says, whether you are new to white nationalism or have been spreading the message for years, the ideas that we talk about actually can help take your own ideas and begin using them to shape reality in your local community. I mean, obviously, we all recognize how overwhelming it can be every day to face the media and political and corporate machine that marginalizes our message and persecutes those who support white pride. And under those conditions, you know, we've found that certain methods allow us to break out from that blockade and allow us to present the observable truth and begin organizing people together locally to accomplish our shared objectives. So please feel free, like we do in the Ozarks and like Tom does in New England, to tailor the basic principles that we're going to talk about within your area and your specific culture and your regional flavor. As we've discussed, you know, here in the Ozarks in Arkansas, you need to be a Razorback fan and a deer hunter and wear camouflage, and that does not fly in New England. It's a different culture, and we will be adaptable. But recently, there was a podcast by a white nationalist leader and spokesman who's been beating the same drum for 20 years. And in his podcast, he said that only his region was the place where a white ethnostate could thrive. Right. Well, how many white nationalist leaders have said that only their plan can be successful? Their way or the highway. You have to do it exactly the way they say it, wear their uniform, say their pledge, march in lockstep with them, and basically it's self-aggrandizement to a point. And I don't want to get into a flame war with persons I respect and who have earned your respect as well. But what it basically is territoriality and pettiness. I don't claim to have all of the answers, and the answers I do have for my region and my culture, where we have an emerging white ethnostate that I refer to as Ozarkia, may not be the right approaches culturally and regionally where you live. If you live in the Appalachians or in New England or in the upper Midwest or the far West or the Pacific Northwest, your approach is going to have to match your local regional culture and the heritage and demography of your region. So we don't really want to have a cookie-cutter approach to all the emerging white ethnostates. We want to give people freedom to operate and to do what works. It's much more important to be successful than to be uniform. And if people want to complain about Ozarkia not having an ocean, well, neither does Switzerland and neither does Austria. As a matter of fact, 1/5 of the world's countries currently do not have an ocean. 44 standing nations in the world today are landlocked, and including 14 in Europe. So domestic expatriates who even want to and are moving to Ozarkia shouldn't be dispelled from that by the fact that we don't have a redneck Riviera. We perhaps will, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. But North Texas, as well as the Great Lakes, could be an avenue not to China, as the person who is critical of my views has, but to our own kinsmen in Europe. But be that as it may, I'm not going to talk about for the entire hour how that person pushing their particular dogma, the drum they've been beating for 20 years, but because the plan is so unnatural and so contrary to human drives and instincts, and so unorganic that they can't even get enough people together after 20 years of fighting for it to occupy one booth in the local McDonald's, whereas the Shieldwall plan has been in effect for less than a year and literally is growing by leaps and bounds exponentially because it's natural, it's instinctive, it's organic, and it's happening already without having to be pushed or forced down people's throats. Now, I wish them well. And I do believe that there are going to be different white areas that will become ethnostates, and One of them may be in the Pacific Northwest. One of them may be in New England. One of them may be in Appalachia. One may be in the upper Midwest, and I believe that one will be here. So different courses for different horses, and I wish them all the best of luck. But Tom and I in New England have found a lot of common ground in discussing the tactics and strategies that we can share across our cultural and regional differences to work together, not in competition like it's a race, not in conflict like only one of us can be right, but in cooperation and recognizing that different regions and cultures can cooperate and align parallel to one another, even if they don't necessarily share commonality in all regards. Because it's not about our egos. It's not about us. It's about you, and it's about our children's future. So, Tom and I agree that whether in New England or in Arkansas, what works well in one region will not necessarily fit in another, and understanding the general beliefs of your people and their culture and the key institutional actors will shape your planning wherever you are. So, you can share our ideas and our tactics and strategies freely and distribute them, remembering that culture comes first and they have to be adapted to where you are. And that having been said, you know, while it's natural to look for politics for change and to be political activist, as so many of the laws which shape our lives emerge from the government, both local and state and federal, it's worth remembering also that politics is always downwind from culture. So long before gay marriage was being pushed, people were marching in the streets and building networks to support the individuals and the businesses who professed those beliefs. We count on our institutions, our legal institutions, and our social and cultural institutions, and our faith, our churches, to protect us, but we lost the political battle because we lost the cultural battle. Now, recently, Australia had an election. It was actually a referendum to vote on voting on whether or not to allow gay marriages, and it passed by about 61-point-something%, which was a surprise to many, but to me it just shows that Australians are not even as based as we white Americans are, which is kind of a surprise in and of itself, but thinking about how quickly they cut to gun control and to the lack of freedom of speech, not really so much. Here in the United States, by contrast, in every single election and every single referendum that people in the states ever had an opportunity to vote about gay marriage, it was voted down. Even in California, and then our Supreme Court said, it does not matter what the will of the people is, it does not matter what the majority won't, it does not matter what your election results are. Yeah, we're going to have gay marriage whether you want it or not. Literally, and with no pun intended, it was shoved down our throats. Bend over and grab your ankles. So, this is another opportunity to point out cultural differences and to talk about the fact that the legal institutions were not a salvation from gay marriage in Australia. They were not a salvation from gay marriage here in the United States. Voting did not help. It did not matter because the controlled media and popular culture and movies and TV had already pushed the acceptance of gay marriage and the homosexual agenda for years, for decades even. So the battle was not won or lost in the courtroom, really, or certainly in the ballot box. It was lost in the cultural arena, just like the Vietnam War was not lost in the skies above Vietnam or in the jungles of Vietnam. The war in Vietnam was lost culturally here in America by the left's control of the news and entertainment media and the counterculture, which is now the dominant established culture because the hippies are now the establishment. So you cannot necessarily hope to win legally, but you can make a difference culturally. Modern culture currently stresses diversity at all costs as the god, as the best possible virtue. So people who parrot those lines about diversity really don't have any idea or any clue what they mean by saying those slogans, but they do know that they will receive social approval, get a pat on the head, and they'll avoid the cost of being ostracized. So, when you accept the limits of political correctness, you concede the cultural battlefield. So while tact matters greatly, you do get more flies with sugar than with vinegar. The first concession is the one you must not make. The first concession is the one you must not make because the slippery slope of impurity spiraling on the way to being a big tent and having open. So, never concede your core beliefs and be sure to encourage others to share your own. You have to take that hard stand and use what I've talked about, the radical flank effect, to be the extremist that others measure themselves by, and so that you allow just to your left the wiggle room for people to say the same thing or virtually the same thing as you're saying in a slightly more moderate and palatable manner, so they don't seem as radical by comparison to you. But you yourself do not concede your core principles. You do not make that first concession. Before you can think about networking with other groups, unless you intend to be a spy for all that you do in those groups, you need to put real thought into how you can authentically present yourself and share your reasons for wanting to protect and preserve your community. And the effort to build the networks with other groups and other individuals often starts really small, within your family or a close circle of friends. Maintaining your organic and natural connection to the community and to the people around you and to what their beliefs and their culture are so that you do not outpace them while you're the radical flank effect. You don't become so alienated from them through outpacing them that you become isolated from them and they do not support you. That's a tricky balance to maintain, but every revolutionary movement and every guerrilla movement has always had to find that balance or become isolated from the population they wanted to support them or the population they wanted to radicalize and then be destroyed by the establishment because they did not have a basis or foundation of support from the people that they're fighting for. So we find that balance. Be the radical flank effect, but don't outpace the radicalization of the people that you're fighting for, so that they cannot identify with you. Now, the interesting thing is that people who look at the world and can logically interpret facts are often closer already to your position than you'd even think, than you would realize. So, except for those who go out of their way to signal their adherence and the following of the popular establishment position, you can always begin probing people right around you by offering statements about the sort of implicit issues that hint at a potential ally, making friends, cherry-picking people, filling them out. And I'll make that more concrete. A lot of people frequently go to dinner parties, and they'll invite over for barbecues people they think might be receptive to a white nationalist message. They can invite a family over to their home or a couple and have a conversation that starts with simple issues and basic politics, and then pick an issue that you think might be something that they could share your concern with. Here in Arkansas, for example, the Second Amendment, gun rights. And share that concern with your target, and don't be afraid to make a stronger statement connecting that single issue to a larger political view. If they begin to seem receptive, then you can understand that you can shape their opinion and a larger opinion by taking the strong position of leadership, once again, the radical flank effect. Make a strong value judgment. Talk about how your white people don't behave that way if you're talking about black crime, and share that you want things to change. You want the world to be a better place. You want to do something about it. And many times you'll really be surprised by just how liberated, how free people feel to be able finally to honestly express their opinion and to realize that they're not the last same person left on the planet. And the same person who really started a conversation virtue signaling about equality might be ranting about niggers within 15 minutes. If you provide the leadership and open that door and lead them on the way. So this skill is incredibly basic. It's just human conversation and radicalization and encouraging people, nudging them along. But it's essential to understanding how you must network On a larger scale also, if you're going to build the informal connections that create a culture to undermine the larger establishment controlled media message. And friends then beget friends. Although, you know, the internet's a great tool for recruiting people and for gaining knowledge, its limitations for organizing are also very well understood. And I've written about that extensively in my article, Without a Net. And that's really the whole purpose of the Shieldwall Network, is to create real-life friendships and in real-life associations of people that you know and trust face-to-face for that time when the internet goes off and stays off. Life doesn't happen online, and political change will not either. The truth is, people have, you know, these vast debates and discourses there online, but the nuts and bolts of how our society runs and how our lives operate are the networking institutions and the governments. If you can get offline and build the networks socially and culturally, then you can take control of political assets and shift money and resources to aid your effort and the movement. So when we talk about becoming a person of influence in your community, you start with your own family and get everyone on board if you can. That's essential. And if you can't get them on board, then you have to isolate them from yourself and from those that you are influencing so they don't counter-influence you and don't counter-influence those that you are influencing. So, you know, an unhappy spouse, for example, will make it impossible for you to spend the time and energy to organize. Make sure you rule your roost, be leader of your home first, and then you can rule your community. Once you've done that, then you can work slowly and pull people together, one and two and three at a time. And if you can connect to 10 families, you then have a nucleus of about 40 people. Don't make the conversations overtly political all at once, and don't make what you talk about into some action plan that no one will enjoy. Just establish a basic bedrock principle that you have families who care about the white race and its plight and how to protect your own. It's very basic, and people can get that. Now, where we operate here in the Ozarks, you know, we find that appealing to a rural working class culture is successful. Where Tom operates in the New England area, he's found it helpful to have people put the groups together, to have a leader bring them together on a regular basis, together socially. And that's also what we're doing here in Arkansas with the Shieldwall Plan. You want to create a space, whether it's in a home or in a private or public meeting area, where people feel welcome to express their opinions. And remember that you're empowering your fellow men to know that he can speak openly without fear of social ostracism. It's crucial. Psychologically, these people, you know, are our kin and our folk. And the trust that we build through proximity with them will help in good times and then in bad. So, taking your group to the next level. As your group grows, as ours is, we want to encourage natural interest that will benefit our people. We're not going to try to impose a single plan, like I talked about before, but rather to articulate common concerns and encourage people to join in efforts to include issues that they already care about. The Shieldwall Network Plan is really an acknowledgement of what is already naturally and organically happening as white people move from majority black areas of Louisiana, Mississippi, and from southern Arkansas, and even from Texas to northern Arkansas. And organizing them because they're already here and they're here for a reason. But obviously, we're not trying to dictate to everyone when or how or to where they should move. Different courses for different horses, once again. Where we operate, local food production is a big thing. And we have people who, you know, enjoy working the land, being farmers, so they work together sometimes to help farmsteaders and homesteaders find resources and bring food to families who need our help. So our people gain a great deal of satisfaction from that as volunteers who can help whites in need, for example, with the Cover Our People With Love pro-white charity, and to create a positive social perception in the local community. And when my wife donates bagfuls of brand new handmade little baby caps and scarves and gloves and booties to local charities to be given to needy white families in our community, you know, people notice that. And we help out whenever we can to be good citizens And that does not go without an impact. So it's very important, this point, very important that we recognize because through your virtuous action, you're creating cognitive dissonance among our enemies and among the normies. Cognitive dissonance means there's two ideas competing at once. The narrative you're fighting with your actions is that white nationalists are bad, that we're evil, we're the devil, right? But when the media is promoting its degeneracy from afar, then your people locally are tending, you know, not just to food in your community, but potentially helping provide heat from the cold, our clothes, winter jackets, and blankets and quilts, and leading from within your churches or within school boards or city councils or putting on public displays of pride for the community, then people who are perpetually undecided about who to believe will be put under a lot of great pressure, a lot of great pressure to see you as the virtues they want. Cognitive dissonance because we are helping our communities and not being outlaws. So as a movement, we put far too much effort and resource into thinking a politician will solve our problems or trying to craft a perfect set of intellectual solutions to any given problem. And that's one of the biggest mistakes out there. And I wrote about that actually this morning in a new article on the Roper Report website called The Cause and the Cure. And it's because, you know, we don't have the ability to really affect such outcomes at present, as much as we might want to. Someday we will, but what we can do now is work in our community or our neighborhood and build a close-knit social network that both spreads the key idea and enriches our lives on the way to balkanization. We have to remember, though, that we're working underneath scrutiny, and depending on where you live and how much attention you want to draw to yourself, the challenge you'll begin to face as things go well is the increased scrutiny that you'll come under from those who seek to disrupt your success. They will try to deplatform you. They'll try to dox you and get you fired from your jobs or to get you blacklisted from social networks. They'll try to talk your friends out of you. They'll try to destroy your homes and your relationships and your families. Now, fortunately, you'll catch a lot less heat than those operating at the political level. But as you calibrate your message for your region, people will take notice. You will be on the enemy's radar. So working through implication is one way to minimize the damage done. Instead of speaking very openly, for those of you who are not yet doxxed and not yet publicly known at the local level and at the public level about white genocide, a very real phenomenon, sure, but organizations might instead locally speak of culture and heritage, promoting a positive European identity. It's worth noting that the culture war moves, and depending upon how radical your area is, once again, focusing on your local region and culture, you can be more aggressive, but remember that the goal should be that whatever you do is open enough to bring in new people who you need to be allies. If what you've set up only draws the same people, then you probably need to reconsider your message, because the focus, the goal, is growth. So take those people who are the most committed, cherry pick them, radicalize them, have them work on projects together of greater urgency, and use them in preparation for the long-term betterment and survival of your community. And good planning will make your lives self-sufficient in good times, so we stress food and energy and security training, as we do with the Shieldwall Phalanx, and survival skills as key points to share, which is why one of the main presentations at the December 2nd meeting will focus on prepping. But don't overlook the importance of just having fun. So, you know, concerts and festivals, handicrafts and social events like we have here in Arkansas with the Shieldwall people all the time. Those kind of events are just as important as a source of pride and a way of showing you're living in the real world instead of just waiting for its demise, waiting for its collapse. Get together with your friends, you know, go out to eat, go to concerts, get together and let your kids play with one another. It's crucial to have those human connections that build bonds and also help show people that we're just normal, red-blooded people like themselves. If you trust the people around you and they trust you, and you're happy working together at the community level because they're your friends, naturally, then you can link to other communities and begin to reclaim your lands one town at a time. And the method's been tested, and it works. So quietly that you don't even realize it's happening at first. But the hints are that it's working when people are just walking around with purpose and with pride, with gleam in their eyes, and we don't have to shout always to be what we are. We just need to rediscover our proud legacy that we are conquerors, we are civilizers, and we are Aryans. And then, once you've influenced local culture and created the platform wherein you have a network locally, you can think about politics, especially once again for those who have not been doxxed, whose names are untainted, and who have been perhaps quiet, private, financial supporters of your local network without being open political activists up to that point. So, about politics, local politics. Really, politicians are largely whores, right? They can't help themselves. It's really the nature of the beast because, you know, they either need a lot of money or a lot of votes to impact policy. And that's why wealthy interests really quickly buy both sides whenever possible, because it's a pretty good bargain for the relatively modest contribution to gain control of all the finances a given local government at that level controls. To give you some idea of the scope locally, even a modest small town of maybe 1,000 people probably has a budget of between $1 to $5 million per year, depending on how wealthy the area is and what size the tax base is, right? So if you have 100 people in your town that are like-minded and someone you trust to lead, then you're just taking control of your first real resources because of low voter turnout. It's all about leverage. So it's important to understand the limitations of the law and public finance. It's more about culture than the courtroom at the beginning. But at every level of government, much of the money is constrained to basic infrastructure and mandates given to them by higher levels. Federal mandates to state and state mandates to local. But put differently, you'll have no choice in how maybe 90% of your budget, the money locally, is spent, even if you do control local government, though how you implement programs can have a big impact. But I know of one group here in Arkansas that's about 2 hours from here that have taken control of their local fire department, their volunteer fire department, and are now taking control of their local city council and will soon be controlling their corner of the county just through this exact same method. And so they may not have the openness of 100% of the city's budget to be given to white nationalist causes. They may not be having a Nuremberg rally there anytime soon, but if they can operate government in concert with the informal network that you've already established, like a shadow government, then you can make decisions about what is and what is not right for the town, and a lot of possibilities emerge if you use your imagination. To offer a concrete example, so a mayor in a given small town, if they've worked with a local nonprofit organization to make sure that anyone in need gets help without having to use welfare, that's great because it keeps people, keeps working families off the system and gets them into work if they don't have work, and it's kept money in the community and removed federal and state government scrutiny from the community and from these people's lives, which is always a good thing. The organizations, you know, work together, the nonprofits and the informal networks that you're establishing, to make sure families have voluntary housing and avoid opening up Section 8 housing locations where federal rules would force them to accept unwanted people. I don't have to define that too clearly for you. You know what kind of people tend to gravitate to Section 8 housing and what kind of people are actually shipped there from other areas of your state by the federal and state government. So the informal network is quietly working to make sure that any unwanted minorities quickly choose to move along through a strategy of exclusion, doing the job the town cannot, but which all agree is necessary, by keeping the federal and the state governments out of the town's business. And basically how? By using local national socialism by taking care of their own. Now, as you have successes in your towns and your counties, it's the next step. Make sure your people sit not just on the council of the city, but also the school board and other boards so you can take control of what is taught and what is permitted. It's a slow and sometimes an uneven process. You will have some rejections. You will have some failures. You will have some defeats. But the important thing is to continue moving forward. And it starts when you begin to see where civic opportunities exist locally in your towns and your counties, and you can bring people into your network who are in those roles or promoting your own people for those roles if none exist that can be won over. The Shieldwall Network here in Arkansas is doing both. Politicians who understand that you control the votes will vote as you demand. That's just their nature. And towns can be won in this way, and entire counties will follow. Now, states are hard to roll. They'll be tough nuts to crack, but having a few state representatives or senators from your team, eventually, if you control a county or two or three, ensures that the money from the capital of the state taxation base flows back for the programs you support to be used in your controlled cities and counties. Now, this is all pretty concrete, and it's nuts and bolts that some of us are not quite ready for yet, but it is a plan that is working. And instead of just calling for everyone to get up and move across the continent to the most liberal left-wing corner facing China, it's a natural and organic plan of how you can become a person of influence in your community, assuming that your community is not majority non-white and on the wrong sides of the front lines in the coming balkanization. One instance of how this has worked really well is that a local town supported a music festival whose purpose was economic development and tourism. The businesses in the town love extra revenue, of course, people coming in to hear the music, and the people like the excitement and the entertainment. But the larger cause, our cause, is served as the event promotes white talent, and it uses subtle cues to white heritage and culture and history, and it serves as an enormous morale boost and recruiting ground, so good begets good. But the important thing is to maintain your standards and your measures of what white culture and history is, and make sure that your white history and culture in your region is not co-opted by non-whites. We don't need Mexicans and niggers and Asians playing the banjo and fiddle to carry forward white culture. We don't want to promote that. We don't want to allow that. We want to counter-signal against that every possible time we have an opportunity to. So, what has been holding us back? Is it people's laziness? They don't want to move? Is it people's Jewishness? They don't want to contribute? Are they stingy? A little bit of both, maybe. But who does give? Instead of counting our enemies, always only count our friends. Who will help you out? Sometimes the people who help you out the most are those who can do the least. Let me explain that. People who cannot, because of their jobs and their professions, get out and hold a sign or yell at Antifa. People who cannot really risk their professions or their family's livelihoods by going to a demonstration and rally can provide financial contributions and direct donations and support to make all of your events possible. And more importantly, they can maintain their own positions and ultimately move into larger positions into elected office locally because they've not been doxed and tainted. These people whom you may initially want to reject because they don't come out and get involved in street actions with you may be your most valuable resources. So who gives and why? You know, a failure of the movement, of the cause, up to this point, has been being ashamed about money. We're ashamed to ask for money. We're ashamed to request it. We feel guilty, right? And while money is highly problematic and it represents a means of control that's used against us, you know, having resources to spend also conveys much needed legitimacy because people love a winner. People want to jump on a bandwagon. No one wants to get involved with a bunch of losers or a bunch of broke people, right? So it also reflects the ability to promote and to outreach and to share and expand what successes you've built from the grassroots, from your network. And as awkward and ungainly as it is, you need to promote your successes. You need to ask for help. You need to promote your intentions because you don't get a chance to put out the simpler pro-white message always overtly as you're beginning to build your network. So government is one side of the coin, and nonprofits are the other. So much of the culture wars fought and won by the white destructionist forces because they're the only ones out there distributing money. If you can feed people when stuff hits the fan, if you can hand out a can of peas to somebody whose family hasn't eaten that day, then they will be glad to dig your ditch or to help man your barricade. If you can provide security and safety and protection to people and their families, then they will accept your leadership. So we cannot abdicate the gathering of resources and assets to our enemies. We cannot win if we have nothing to offer our people except high-minded ideals and some abstract vision of a white ethno-state future. People are motivated by their bellies and by their base human needs and desires, and that will be the same when we have the opportunity to take advantage of the vacuum of power when the collapsing crisis happens and the balkanization hits. So, organizations exist largely dependent upon and responsive to right now government and foundation donors, and they're the means by which ideas are interjected into the community now and into the larger dialogue. We've not really ever competed so far at that level because the social system has ostracized any pro-white group from public legitimacy. So we need to realize how that power is exerted and begin fighting back. Some observations, you know, from having been involved in these fights is that having dual-purpose organizations are extremely helpful. You can get that check, really, for $5,000 to $10,000 just as easily as the horrible organizations do with some local organization and a few friendly letters to state legislators or nonprofit organization presidents. And these are really your government tax dollars, these grants. You can work to get them for things that benefit your group and your community, depending on how you word it and phrase it and what you use it for initially. So you can make sure that these projects have a good public face and, where possible, support anonymous donations from not only your people, but from people who are not yet your people, but might be willing to help out a project which benefits your people, whether they're within your communities or outside of them. It's also good where you can have membership organizations and you encourage your own people to give. And that's limited, but it's a challenge, you know, because it's off-putting to a lot of people. However, the more people you have, the easier it is to get someone else to foot the bill. So as your network grows, the easier you might find success to achieve. So how this all pulls together, sharing a lot of ideas, a lot of tactics, a lot of strategies to encourage people what can happen with the next step of local community organizing and grassroots outreach as you become persons of influence in your community. You can see how it begins to take shape. And this vision offers some guideposts of ideas in execution that have worked to build a foundation to improve your community in a way that is sincere to white nationalist beliefs. And it goes without saying that you need to be intelligent about whom you trust and what you share, and always keep in mind that success also always breeds envy. And we've seen that recently as well, haven't we? But if you start with your family and connect a few families together and a few friends together, people that you meet online that are within your area, that you meet face-to-face and become actual friends with to build that trust and to create your network like we are with a shield wall, you'll have the core of a group to make change happen. With them, with that core, be open about your beliefs, back each other up, and build strength in that core, in that alliance. Embrace your interest and those civic avenues that are open to you, whether in the public sector or whether they're in community organizations or a local church. Win some successes. Earn the respect of your community, and you'll find people seeking your advice and politicians eventually asking for your support on a local level. It will start small and grow. You set your prices reasonably, and you use government to push your cause both financially and legally, as the other side has done, and you'll be better prepared to face all the challenges ahead. Another path forward that you can consider is to support local businesses, family-owned businesses, not franchises, but also to create businesses that cover needs valuable to the movement and to find employment for your own people. Having those sorts of relationships can sometimes complicate how people connect, but putting wealth into the pockets of people locally creates redundancy for meeting needs in a pinch and hopefully opportunity for more of your people. So having these people on board in local businesses very much strengthens your informal social networks and your political clout. Talk to people. Get out of the house. Shake their hand. Smile at them. Become charismatic local politicians. Don't be afraid to jump back and forth from going online to build what you're trying to accomplish. You know, it might take working through 100 people to find one who is useful, but that still has value in terms of showing energy and the few people that you collect, how it's done. Take your people that you find online, work geographically where possible, and work to bring them into the circle of real people. Have meetings. And keep in mind that it only takes one connection to succeed. Now, in conclusion, the struggle ahead of us is hard, but it's important to remember history has been shaped by those and with those who have the will to create their own futures. Our shared American heritage is of people who stood up and took charge when the strongest and best of us decided that we had suffered too much and we wanted to regain control of our destiny as a people once again. So we have to prepare ourselves for that same call. So, you know, as you organize, as you meet people, as you create circles of trust, as you create friends in real life and build your local network, consider always what will be helpful in a good situation and essential in a critical one. All the things people think they think, all the things that they think they know will fade away against that stark reality. And if you are well prepared, not only will you survive, not only will your family survive, but you'll become the leaders of your community who make decisions and take charge and take control of that rising ethnostate. Folks, until that day comes, all we can do is gather our strength and work in unity to build our networks. And you likely won't like everyone with whom you connect. You won't like everyone that you have to work with. You may not even consider everyone that you have to work with a friend. And there'll always be conflicts of interest. But you need to settle them through compromise or through peaceful separation. If compromise is not possible, remembering that there is a bigger cause and time is not our friend, and remembering what motivated you to fight for your future, because discipline is remembering what it is that you really want. Above all, remember, as always, to think racially, act locally, but no matter what, keep it white.
Can you hear the student band? I think they're getting out of hand. Well, you know what happened to those who complain? We've got to stop them seeing light. Let them think it's all right. Cause the fire acts out to keep them entertained. Well, the wells have not run dry. Do we really need to lie? We'll say it's a national emergency. We're set a wedding full of clowns. And we'll kick them while they're down. Get the banks control, cause they are friends to me. Let's go and find a better place. We'll call it New America. Won't it be a lovely place to be? Imperial material, the mind of New America. The best idea since democracy.
You are listening to Radio Aryan. For an alternative to the anti-white system on RadioArea.com.